watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this
you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, or Free Radio Asheville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week we continue with our bi-weekly free school lecture series with economist Doug Dowd on the USA, where we are, where we're headed. Today, a focus on health care and Social Security, which will follow with a reading from another economist, Michael Hudson, who lays out the motive behind the Bush plan for Social Security privatization, a last-ditch effort to save Wall Street. It's a Ponzi scheme, says Hudson, with short-term gains for speculators and disastrous consequences for the population as a whole. So we begin. Here's Doug Dowd.
Okay, my voice is a little worse tonight than usual, because as many of you know, I have this wonderful woman who has forced me to live with her, who's from Italy, and right now she's back in Italy for 3 or 4 weeks, something done to her teeth, and I haven't had anybody to speak to except the dog, and when I don't use my voice, it disappears, so within about 10 or 15 minutes, it just starts coming back again, and then you'll be sorry. I hope. It may be that it's a permanent condition, but, okay, we are in the next stage of this, quote, semester's progression, if that's what it is. And so what I wish to talk about tonight, and for the next meeting also, is under the heading of human and social policy, human and social needs, I should say. As some of you, or most of you know, this is all part of a book that I've been working on. The subtitle of that particular chapter is Greed and Guile versus Decency and Sanity. Just beginning to think about talking about this evening, and I'm going to talk about health care, education, housing, nutrition, opportunity. These are human needs and also society's needs. Just beginning to talk about them, and knowing, as you all know also, that there's just a tremendous assault being taken against all kinds of decent social policy. It struck me that not struck me in the sense that I didn't know this before, but that for the first time in my life, for the first time in the life of the United States, there is an assault, not just on domestic policies such as this, but there's a joined assault on everything that's important and everything that must be reversed. We have become an extremely much more militaristic society than ever before in our history, and we've always been militaristic. Okay? One of the great books that William Appleman Williams wrote, which is called Empire as a Way of Life, he lists 154 wars that the United States entered itself before 1945, almost all of them undeclared wars. Okay? Little wars, big wars, but all of them wars, all of them moving in on other peoples all over the globe, all over the globe. Africa, you didn't know about that, did you? Asia, of course you knew about that. Latin America, Europe, everywhere. So at the same time that everything that we need to do at home in terms of domestic policy is going in exactly the wrong direction at an always accelerating pace, it's also true that we're also becoming more and more militaristic at the same time. And it's also true that at the same time, and for connected reasons, and everything is connected, we're also moving against civil liberties, moving against the freedom of the press. We're also doing everything we can to ruin the environment and to prevent any kind of prevention for the environment, and so on. In other words, there's something very big happening now. It just scares the hell out of me. It isn't just that it scares me. It's so disgusting. The people who are doing it are just people, they're beneath discussion. And of course, the purpose of these classes that I give is to try to help people to understand more than they already understand, and everyone who's here already understands a lot, or you wouldn't be here. But then do something about it. Because we're not in a position where we can, so to speak, wait for somebody else to do it. We are the somebody else that other people are waiting for to do it. And there's so much to be done. So very much to be done. My own guess is that if everyone who should would get off his or her ass and become seriously political, we probably still would lose. Okay? Just as in Germany in 1929, 1930, 1931, if everyone who should have been doing it, they probably would have lost also to the Nazis. Probably would have lost. But there's such a thing as going down well, honestly, as a human being, instead of becoming a good German, as those people came to be called, who didn't like Hitler but did absolutely nothing about it until after World War II, they said, I was against what he was doing. Well, we're not going to have any time after World War II. Because what's going on in this society now, at this time, by this country, is going to lead probably to the destruction of the world within a century, maximum. Environmentally, and probably more probably, by warfare. The United States has an arrogance about nuclear weapons. It's not only okay for us to have them, and maybe a couple of others who are our presumed allies, at least up to now, to have them, but it's not okay for anyone else to have them. There's something it's beyond thought. And then we are that way about everything. About foreign trade, about this, about that, about the other thing. So that's all. Ciao.
Be hopeful.
Shall we go out and preach
now? I am hopeful. I am hopeful. I wouldn't say hopeful. I still have hope. I am not full of hope, but I have hope for the reason I've given so many times in my writings and here. We cannot predict the future. If you can't predict, you've got to act as though the future is ours in some sense or another, or it isn't all theirs, and so on. Of that, more later. What I want to do now, in terms of human and social needs, is have a beginning introduction, so to speak, to set the stage for it so we know what I'm talking about, so that you and I will both know what I'm talking about, and then go on to examine in that disorder healthcare or the lack of it, and education, healthcare, then Social Security, then education, then housing and hunger. But I want to begin, before I go into that list, I'm going to begin after the introduction to talk about a way of thinking about this, which is to talk about the living wage, which is something that is like Greek to people in this country. So let me get started. I might say, as I was saying to Michael before, as almost all of you know, there's a website for the class, www.dougdowd.org. And on the website are not only all kinds of articles and essays by myself and many, many others, but also there are excerpts from two of my recent books. One is the encyclopedia called The Great Broken Promises of America. All this is free, of course. And the other one is a book that hasn't yet been published and probably won't be, which is called Where We Are and Where We're Headed. And if you look on the website and poke into, you'll get articles, books, da 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 da. It'll say what's new. If you click onto what's new, then you will get excerpts from both of those books. And as it happens, what is there that's relevant for this evening and next time is health and Social Security. And also, it's a mistake, but it's a nice mistake. It says, the very title of this evening, Human and Social Needs, is on there as Chapter 3 out of the Broken Promises of America. Well, the Broken Promise of America is an encyclopedia. It doesn't have any chapters. That's Chapter 3 of the new book, Where We Are and Where We're Headed. But that whole thing that I'm going to be talking about tonight is on the web, okay? So you can read the whole thing if you want to. And it's about 40, 50 pages long. Why would you want to? So let's get started. It's barely possible for me ever to talk about anything without starting out with a kick in the ass to economics. Because economics isn't just that it doesn't help us to understand what's going on, it makes it more difficult for people to understand anything that's going on. It's like having mud on the road when you're trying to make a difficult voyage. And economics, in some sense or another, has an excuse we're not ever treating properly of human and social needs. Because when economics began, and we can say for our present purposes it began with Adam Smith and was taken up by David Ricardo, we're speaking about books written in 1776 and then 1817. The kind of world that existed then was such that it wasn't possible for everyone to have a living wage, which I'll discuss in just a minute. It was just not possible. The kind of level of life that people were living in the 18th century, in the 17th century, in the 16th century, was really very nicely put into a phrase by Hobbes: nasty, brutish, short. There wasn't the kind of productivity, whether on the land or in factories, and there were no factories, that would enable people to have a wage that we would call, that I will call, a living wage. They weren't able even to have a subsistence wage. You understand? As we would define subsistence. I'm not talking about automobiles and television sets. I'm talking about something that will keep you healthy. The lifespan was very short. That's why. That's another way of saying the subsistence wage was not being met. On the other hand, I will add to this right now that when industrialization really took hold in the 1820s, began to take hold in Britain, the first time in the world, and then really went into something that had to be called revolution, industrial revolution, in that period from 1820s, 30s, 40s, 50s, in that period, the average worker in Britain's lifespan went down by 20% as productivity was increasing. Then it was a social problem, not an economic problem, you understand? But after the 1850s, by the time you get into the 1860s, then the kind of, as Marx would put it, the economic surplus was getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and then it was possible to begin to think and act on a living wage. Or to put it differently, for all the people in the society to live decently, to be able to have adequate nutrition, adequate health, adequate education, adequate housing, and so on and so on. To begin to move toward that, at least. By the time you get into the 20th century, it was essential for capitalism, if it was to survive, to see to it that people had that, or the economic surplus could not be used, could not be, excuse me, it could not be
achieved.
Maintained. It couldn't be maintained. Okay? Couldn't be profitable, and so on and so on. And what resolved the problem, so to speak, with two great big belches were the two world wars, which I'll get into later on, in terms of all kinds of raising the standard of living. The very notion of standard of living would have been Greek to the British in the 19th century, or to say nothing of the 18th century. Capitalism could be looked upon, or I should say industrial capitalism could be looked upon, as Adam Smith looked upon it, as something that would be a painful but beneficial set of processes and relationships, which over a century or so, he thought, would in fact make it possible not for workers to cease to be exploited, because he knew damn well they were being exploited and thought they had to be, but that the exploitation wouldn't be as, so to speak, bloody. There's a nice book, for those of you who are going to pursue things like this, by a guy named Eli Ginsberg, who's a sociologist, called The House of Adam Smith, in which he recognizes just what was wrong and some of the things that were right about Smith. Smith was a decent guy, you know, and decency has to be refined and redefined as time goes on in terms of what's possible and so on. But when it became possible, by the end of the 19th century, at the latest, for there to be a genuine big rise in the material well-being, or the decline of the material awful down-being of the average worker, economics profession didn't change one word, one comma, one jot, one tittle. It's never given any attention whatsoever to human and social needs. As I've said to you before, those of you who've been around here, the word need is a four-letter word in economics. It does not exist. It's a dirty word. They never, ever, ever talk about it. Wants? Yes. Wants. But needs, no. They never even talk about it, which is a disgrace to the profession, except that profession is so disgraceful, it can't be disgraced. So, though capitalism was able to go on its voyage, beginning to take straight, that is to say, as the 19th century began, without any kind of need to deal with social needs or human needs, it was just assumed by economics, by Smith too, but in a more complicated way, it was just assumed that the free market would take care of everything, which is just plain it's absolutely, if you think about it, and economists don't think about it, if you think about it, it's quite clear the free market can't take care of everything, or it can't take care really of most things that are important. All it can do is to take care of production, consumption in the market, given a certain level of income and a certain level of production, so on, so on, so on. Everything has to be automatic. Everything has to be, everything in free market capitalism has to take place without any plan, without any organization, without any direction, without anything. And a miracle is supposed to come out, the best of all possible worlds. Well, there is planning under capitalism, but it's planned by big business. And when Smith wrote, and this is to his defense, so to speak, there wasn't any big business, except financial, relatively speaking, and so on. Some trade, relatively speaking, big. Midgets compared with what we mean by big today. Not even midgets. Seeds, nothings. So let me move from that now to saying what, if we're going to talk about human and social needs. And my own position on this is that if you want to know what social needs are, you have to know what human needs are first. That's not the end of it. But that's very well, if there's a pyramid, that's all that's left up on top is very little compared. Everything that is called, comes under the heading of human needs, in effect, provides the satisfaction of society's needs. Up to a point. That point is not even worth discussing at this point, at least. One of the things that living in this kind of a society, when I say that, I don't mean just the United States, but especially the United States, it isn't that we're never taught to think straight about things like human needs. It's that the ways that we are taught to think keep us from thinking straight about human needs. It's as though we're gassed. We can't have healthy lungs. We can't breathe properly. We just don't. It's really extraordinary. When I discuss healthcare in just a few minutes, I hope I'll show you, I'll refer to something that's going on right now, which is a conference, a national conference, which they're discussing the recognition we really have to change the healthcare system. And these are the things they come up with. It's as though they opened up a lunatic asylum and said, let's have a conference on healthcare. Not a lunatic asylum. Asylum of people whose brains are damaged. Okay. So, I've mentioned the living wage now many times. In talking about that, it's necessary to say a few words about the minimum wage, which we have in the United States, which is a glorious $5.15 an hour, which if you worked 8 hours a day, 365 days a year, you'd still be well below the poverty line. And the poverty line itself is an understatement by about 50%, of which I have discussed earlier. The whole idea of our whole definition of poverty is a disgrace. And I might say that in Europe, in Western Europe, they define a person as impoverished if his or her income is less than half of the median wage. If we did that in this country, the poverty rate would be something like 18% instead of what we, not 18%, but instead of some, it would be about a quarter of the population. But we define poverty in such a way that it's a disgrace. So the living wage would be, let's say that we were to double the minimum wage, make it $10.30, okay, an hour. That would still leave us just about at the poverty level. For a person, for an individual, that's $19,000 a year. Try that sometime. The living wage would be something like $14 an hour, which would give you about $30,000 a year. Okay. I might say that Barbara Ehrenreich, who's really a very good writer for one thing, and a very good thinker for another, has a lovely little book called
Nickels and Dimes.
Nickels and Dimes, that some of you I'm happy to hear have read it, not surprised to hear that, in which she talks about this whole thing. And it's really it explodes you.
Is that when she went undercover? Yeah.
She went to work, and she quit her job, or she stopped earning income, I should say. She went to work at shit jobs, you know, working in motels, and work as a waitress, and so on and so on, and just taking care of herself that way. And as she says, and I happen to know Barbara, not intimately, but, well, intimately. She used to be, she used to live in the Bay Area. She's a wonderful person. In any case, she was quite open about the whole thing, that the kind of troubles that she endured in this situation were not the kind of troubles that the other people endured, because she had a life to go back to. You know, and you can't forget that. You know, if you're a journalist, you know, you can't forget that. If you're a journalist in Iraq, it's different. If you're a journalist reporting the news, you're going to be scared shitless all the time yourself, but you know you're going to go, you're going to get out of here, you know, sometime. So your whole attitude is very different. So, let me begin by discussing briefly the leading economist of our time, Milton Asshole Friedman, which is too kind a way of describing him. He lives about three blocks from me on Russian Hill. If I ever see him, if I'm riding, driving my car, I'm going to run the piece of shit right over. He's old, he's older than I am. I can beat him. I could probably even beat him in a fight. He's just a little runt. He's about this big. Yeah. He lives in a big fancy place up in Russian Hill. Milton Friedman, in 1962, put out his book with his demented wife, And this is what he proposed. He advocated the elimination. The word is elimination. Okay? He advocated the elimination of all taxes on corporations, the elimination of the graduated, that is to say, progressive income tax, the elimination of free public education, the elimination of Social Security, which of course had been done in 1935, the elimination of the food and drug laws, the elimination of the licenses of doctors and dentists, the elimination of government post office monopoly, the elimination of government relief from natural disasters like tsunami and so on, the elimination of the minimum wage law, the elimination of ceilings on interest rates charged by usurious lenders, the elimination of laws prohibiting heroin sales, and that's the only thing I could go for with them, the elimination of making drugs illegal. At least he was consistent. He's against all laws that had to do with anything that bought and sold, okay? Anything that had to do with money. Not against speed laws or something like that. The elimination of nearly every form of government intervention that goes beyond the enforcement of property rights, contract laws, and the provision of national defense, which should be mostly private as far as he's concerned. Now, that was in 1962. Almost everything he's called for has been done, or it's well on its way, or within 2 or 3 years, as things are now going, it'll be done. If you think that the people are trying to reform Social Security, you're out of your mind. They're trying to get rid of it. And they were trying to get rid of it before it started in 1935 for a very simple reason. And it's the same reason now, except with relatives. It takes money away from the financial sector. Money that might go to the insurance companies, money that might go into this, money that might go into that. The hell with it. That's what they're trying to do, is to get rid of it. And so on and so on. So that was what Friedman is, in fact, the Adam Smith of our time, except Adam Smith, as I tried to say a while ago, was a relatively decent person. In his time, he was trying to do good by getting rid of really terribly corrupt governmental things going on, which were, in fact, to the benefit of a very small percentage of people of that time. Friedman's trying to do just the opposite. He's trying to enhance corruption for the advantage of a very small percentage of the population. So a living wage would be one that isn't defined exactly in terms of dollars, although one can define it for the United States now that way. It would be defined, rather, in terms of what makes it possible for all human beings to recognize their possibilities and to live in a healthy way. And one of the things that I see as basic among the basic needs is not like something like food and clothing. It's opportunity. If there's one thing that capitalism never allows to have happen, if there's one thing that on grounds of humanity should be there for everybody, it's the same opportunities for everybody with respect to everything. That is to say, when you're born, you're equal. You should be allowed, you're equal in terms of your needs and your possibilities, except in terms of, a list of things. Your parents, the age, the era in which you're born. That's the place where you're born. Your color, your gender, your genes, and so on. Well, you can't do much about the genes, but you can eliminate all those other things by saying equal opportunity. I said this quotation to some of you before, and I always put it in whatever I write when it comes to these things, from Stephen Jay Gould, who was a marvelous human being, died last year, at the age of 60, through some fool doctor's mistake. When they were talking about Einstein a few years ago, what a marvelous brain he had, and indeed he did have, Gould wrote, "I am not much interested in the size or nature. I am not as much interested in the size or nature of Einstein's brain as I am in the virtual certainty that there are millions of people working in fields and factories, millions of people who have something like equal qualities. Now, we find that hard to believe because we find it hard to think straight about things like this. It's so easy for us when we look at somebody who's got his hand or her hand out on the street to do what the name of that nice book was, to blame the victim. That fool person, if only that fool person had done what I've done with my life, he or she would be where I am, which is bullshit, of course. The chances for 90% of the people in this world of ever, 90% I think is a very conservative figure, ever reaching their possibilities as human beings in terms of their understanding, in terms of their appreciation of the things that are beautiful and important, in terms of the use of their possibilities, the chances of them ever getting anywhere near it are about 1,000,000 to 1 against. And it's a socialized, an institutionalized set of obstacles. It isn't something that nature put on the ground for us. If you're talking about the Aborigines in Australia, it's one thing. If they're sitting out in the wilderness by themselves and so on and so on, then they're pretty much equal except in terms of gender, so long as there are no whiteys around. But if you're talking about our world today, the modern world, this world could accommodate, not just accommodate, that's an old-fashioned way for Dowd to think about this. This world would be so much different, so extraordinarily different, if everyone could reach their possibilities, to say nothing of their ability to appreciate literature, music, art, nature, everything. There's so much all of you, all of us in this room have in us. Here I am, Professor Dowd, with all kinds of honors. I mean, there's this honor, and there's that honor, and there's the other honor. With all kinds of, with all a very good life. And I know better than anyone else knows how ignorant I am and how much that has to do with my education. Okay? I'm not modest. I know a lot. But I also know I don't know an awful lot. I also know I haven't ever had the chance to become sensitive to all kinds of things which I could have become. Now, I'm not feeling sorry for myself. I've had an absolutely marvelous life, relatively speaking. And as far as I'm concerned, not just relatively speaking. But I know in my own self, as you must know in yourselves, or perhaps you had it twisted out of your heads, the kinds of things you could have been. But suppose you were just a little girl, as I like to say, born in Jackson, Mississippi, 90 years ago. Whack! Think about the possibilities that she will never, never did have of making it. Yet, some people jump up, climb the world way out of that. I recommend this book often, Man Child in the Promised Land. What was his name?
Claude Brown.
Here's a kid born in the ghetto, gets into the usual things that kids are going to get in the ghetto. He's going to be getting into drugs. He's going to do this. And he goes. He gets arrested this time. He gets arrested again. He gets arrested again. He goes to jail. He goes to juvenile. He goes to this sort of thing. And just by good luck, in the midst of this great pool of bad luck of his life, when he's in jail, prison, I should say, there's an instructor, a teacher, who begins to talk to him as though he were, don't laugh, a human being, and begins to help him learn. And the Claude Brown who wrote that book was a lawyer when he wrote that book. He wouldn't have done it ever if it hadn't been for that one particular guy in that prison who happened to say, hey, try this, try that. Gave him a little love. I said love. A little attention. As though he were a human being. Now, virtually no one gets that kind of attention. in this society. I didn't get it. I'm not bitter about it. I'm just saying, I'm Lucky Louie, and I didn't get it. I was lucky. All kinds, the whole list, real list of lucky things that just, if it hadn't been for the luck, I would never have been able, I wouldn't be up here now having read all those books, etc., etc., etc. It's such a crime. It's such a major, major crime. And we're talking about the United States. But if you open up your eyes and look at Asia and Latin America, Middle East, Africa, I mean, it's enough to make a revolutionary out of you, except revolutionary is just a word. It's not a reality. Now, 2005, it is possible, it is literally possible for all people in the world, irrespective of what they look like, what their gender is, where they live, within 50 years, for all of them to have, be living, let's call it, with a living wage. All of them to have a decent education with hope. Within a half century, that would be possible, because you can't have all this goddamn wonderful technology that we have of communications and transportation and production and this and that and the other thing, and not be able to do that. If we can have these goddamn things flying around in the sky and missiles and space things, and we can goddamn well see to it. And I don't know if you're as angry as I am. But I am as angry as I am. Because we're talking about 6+ billion people who are doomed. Doomed by a handful of people in the world who are white American powerhouses with a couple of blacks thrown in to make it look better. Condoleezza. And what's that guy? Scalia, he's an Italian. Disgrace to Italy. Clarence. Ugh.
Thomas.
So, underlying everything that I'm talking about here, inequality, which is all I've been talking about right now. I've been talking about inequality. There's no reason for it at all, except that the people have had power throughout history, like to have that power. And they want anybody else to have it, and they have the power to see that nobody else is going to get it. Well, the United States, the richest nation in all of history, in the United States, in this period in which everything has become, production, productivity has become so extraordinary that it's embarrassing the kind of shit everybody's buying just to keep the wheels turning. Consumerism is a way of getting people to pay for shit, borrow for it, and so on. It's massive, massive waste. Massive waste. Buying things that you keep for a while, throw them away. Buying things you run for a while, they break down. Deliberately break down. So we're going crazy trying to know how to keep business profitable by having people buy stuff, as Baran put it, that they don't need. So much stuff that we don't need. So, here I'm quoting now in terms of inequality, I'm quoting from Lawrence Michel and his companions, Economic Policy Institute. They put out every other year, they put out the state of work in America, like this, statistics and analysis. Since the 1970s, this is a quote, the U.S. economy has consistently produced the highest levels of economic inequality, with a strong tendency to rise. And this was written 3 or 4 years ago, with a stronger tendency to rise, even as inequality was relatively stable or declining in most of the rest of the OECD. That's the 20 or so nations' richest industrial economies. And poverty is deeper in the United States and more difficult to escape than in the rest of the OECD. The lack of redistributive, that is to say social, policies only exacerbates the high levels of poverty and income inequality in the United States. Our health care force, which I think almost all of you know, is the worst. But most Americans think it's the best. It drives you crazy. And how are you supposed to know? Well, I know because I live in Italy half of every year, and I've been doing it for who knows how many years now. And just to give you an idea before I turn to health care, right, which is very soon, as some of you know because you've been sitting in this class for years, because I've talked about my Italian experience, which is the way I found out about it. In the last, well, I started to go to Italy almost 40 years ago. The very first year I was there, the very first week I was there, I was hospitalized, run over by a truck. It was a small truck, to be sure, but it was a truck. And my wife, my then wife, who's now dead, was also run over by that same truck. In Rome, this was. We were going to a meeting of the Fulbright professors, which is what I was. You had to go to a meeting, and I couldn't get to the meeting because I was run over by a truck. I was hospitalized. Broke three ribs. They still hurt me when I sleep. My wife had a brain concussion, and so on. We were hospitalized. And that's where I began to learn about health care. You know what they made me do before they would take me into the hospital? They made me show some identification. So I showed them my California driver's license. See? I was in the hospital. My wife was in the hospital. They took us out of the Roman hospital. We went up to Bologna, which is where I was working. I was in the Bologna hospital. How much did it cost? That much. I have been in the last 20 years, because I'm an avid and expert bicyclist, I've been hospitalized 5 times for having bicycle accidents. Once for falling down on the street just walking. Hospitalized 5 times with brains, hearts, legs, toes, everything. Every time they make me show my identification. California driver's license. Never cost me one penny. They don't even talk about it. They don't talk about it. I have had home visits from the doctors. Now, that's because they like me, love me, admire me, ask for my autograph. That's the reason they come. But nevertheless, it's extraordinary. I might say that a couple of Italian friends of my wife's came to visit us a couple of years ago, and they were worried about their boy, because a 12-year-old boy who had a pain down here that could have been something. So they took him to CalPAC, which is where we are, to the emergency room to see, because it was a pain, it was really hurting him. They took him there. They got a bill for $2,700. He was there for a half an hour. This is CalPAC, my own hospital, but I have insurance. There's something so immoral about this. We're talking about sick people. Something so obscene about it. Healthcare is a need. It's not something to be bought and sold. I don't understand how anyone can say anything different, unless one believes in capitalism. And almost everybody in this country, and a good many other places now, believes in capitalism. Believes in this thing that's called the free market. Believes in this stuff that economists call rational choice. It's up to each person to use his or her economic resources, their income, to buy those things that they want most and pay the relatively the best prices for them. Marx, as you know, became really famous for Capital, the three volumes of Capital, which he didn't even finish, but which he started, in some sense started in the 1850s. He actually written three volumes before that on the political economy of capitalism, in effect, the theory. But he started writing in the 1840s, 1843, 1844, and you can find his books. Find this stuff, it's called Philosophical Writings or Early Writings or whatever. And already the very first thing he wrote had to do with, in effect, the socioeconomic philosophical meaning of capitalism, psychological meaning of it. And as some of you know, this is where he began to talk about the alienation of human beings who would have to work under capitalist conditions, where labor is made into a commodity, which it never was until the modern era. There were slaves. They were a commodity. But in the medieval period, which preceded capitalism, you were not bought and sold. You didn't have a wage. You worked. You had the obligation to work for someone who had the obligation to protect you and allow you to subsist in the medieval world. A serf was not a thing to be that you would want to be, but you weren't a commodity. But the commodification of both land and labor began to take place as the medieval era ended. And it ended because capitalism is beginning. So by the time the 17th and 18th century is going on, you have, by the end of the 18th century, land and labor. Land first, therefore labor, because the people were pushed off the land by the enclosure movement, and then they became something you could buy and sell. Once you commodified land and labor, Marx argued, once labor became something you can buy and sell, something you had to sell yourself, to sell your labor power, that would then cause human beings, the ones who were doing that working, and he also thought the ones they were working for, to become dehumanized. He called it alienated, borrowing from Hegel. They would cease to be human. But also he thought that what would also happen was that everything would become commodified, that everything would become money, 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 money. Money makes the world go round. Have you all seen that film? Money makes the world go round. Further alienating themselves, in which money becomes the focus of existence. When that happens, it happens to us in our heads, in our hearts, in our feelings, in our ways of thinking, our ways of feeling. We don't know how to think and be human beings anymore. What we are is workers and customers, buyers and sellers. We sell ourselves, we buy something else. And there's such a tawdry kind of a process going on that only a small percentage of the population can partially avoid. And those are people who, by good luck, broadly defined, find ways to do something that is meaningful to them, which usually means they think they're doing something useful as distinct from something that's saleable, and so on. So, healthcare, incidentally, in the 18th century was not a commodity. It didn't even exist, except for the rich, the powerful. But if somebody was poor, if you were a peasant, you got sick, you got sick. If it was serious, you died. If it wasn't serious, you got better. If you broke a leg, you broke a leg. Go broke a leg, broke a leg, break a leg. Healthcare didn't become a concept until it came to be something that the population as a whole could be considered as needing or as being in want of, as the case may be. There wasn't even the term healthcare until after World War II, so far as I know. It didn't even exist. And then after World War II, of a sudden, historically speaking, by the 60s, and the war ended in 45, by the 60s you had governmental healthcare programs all over Europe, all over East, all over Western Europe, and also in the Soviet Union. Governmental healthcare programs. They came into existence only under political pressure coming from the bottom up, from organized workers. It was in all cases, the unions, with their political parties, who forced parliaments to pass laws that would provide health care, and I might add, public education, and I might add, housing. If you go to a place like Bologna, where I live, you see these nice big housing things. They're public housing. It isn't that you don't pay anything to get in. You're subsidized. We started to do that in the 1930s in this country. We've abandoned it now. Now the public housing, I don't know how much you know about this. I'll talk about it when we get to housing. The housing projects of today subsidize the upper middle class. You understand? Not the poor. And so on and so on. I'll give you the details when we get to housing, but you can't. There's the Federal Housing Administration, and it has loans and subsidies that you can apply for. And when it was first begun, it was just for people who couldn't afford decent housing. Now it is for those who can afford decent housing and get a subsidy for doing it. But there's all kinds of other things that are related to this which make it terrible, because as suburbanization has become the fever over the last 50 years or so, the population, the nice population, the good population, is by and large moving out of the cities and into suburbs, okay? Whereas the well-to-do part of the population that stays in the cities is getting, not all of them, but some of them, more as a percentage than the poor, getting federal housing subsidy. They're going to people with incomes over 100,000 on the average. Okay? That's not what they were meant to be. Congress is I know that there are exceptions. There is Barbara Lee, and then there is Barbara Lee. Oh, there's Wellstone in the Senate. No, Wellstone, no. He had an accident. I'm sorry. No, there's at least three people in the Congress out of 535, really good people much of the time. But you can't really be in Congress anymore if you're decent. A bill gets through Congress with somebody voting for it, even though he or she's against it, because they are going to want to get something of theirs gone through. You know, deals are deals and deals and deals and deals and deals. And everybody says, well, you know, it would have gone through anyway, and so on and so on. This corruption is king. And the expression, everybody's doing it, has always been and will always be an excuse for people to become corrupt, for violating their own standards. Or, if it isn't just corruption in the sense that you get something out of it, it's convincing yourself it's hopeless. No use in me doing this, nobody else is doing it, so am I. Two questions about health care. Which of the 20 richest nations has the highest health care costs? You, of course, know the answers to these questions. Has the highest costs? We, of course, do. Of those same nations' average citizens, which receive the worst health care? So I will spare you the long quotation about that, but some of the details of it have to do with the hidden government. This is from a Harvard study. It's quoted in the thing, which you can get on the website. I'm quoting now, the hidden government health spending has a major impact on family budgets. In 1999, a family of four with average health costs spent $7,000 for their own health expenses and premiums. In addition, they paid $10,300 in health care taxes. You didn't know you were paying taxes, did you? About $1,600 for tax subsidies, $943 for government workers' coverage, and $7,800 for government health programs like Medicare and Medicaid. And many uninsured families pay thousands of dollars in taxes for the health care of others. We pay the world's highest health care taxes. So when people say, well, okay, all that good health care in Italy, don't people have to pay for it? Sure they have to pay for it. They pay for it in taxes. But it's a relatively progressive tax system, you understand? And that's the thing you always have to read. But much of the money is squandered. I'm still quoting. The wealthy get tax breaks. HMOs and drug companies pocket billions in profits at the taxpayer's expense, of which I'll give you some details later on. Every other developed nation has national health insurance. We've already paid for it, but we don't get it. We spend over $200 billion each year on paperwork, in insurance companies, in hospitals, in doctor's offices, at least half of which could be saved through national health insurance. We spend $150 billion, this is 5 years ago, on medications. It's gone up 10-20% since that time. At prices 50% higher than Canadians pay for exactly the same drugs, and so on. Of all the rich nations, we provide the least coverage. From 15 to 20% of us are without any coverage at all. Among the other rich countries, the worst rate is under 1%. And all those other societies have higher longevities and lower infant mortality rates than ours, and so on. And now we've reformed Medicare, and we are reforming Medicaid. We've had a Medicare bill under Mr. Bush, and this is what it does. Medicare covers only 90 days of hospital care. Well, that's a lot, you might say, but it's not a lot if you need 110 days. And Medicare is for old people, like me. But I don't need it, because I have CalPERS from California State. Only half of the poor are carried by Medicaid, are covered by Medicaid. More than 40 million are without any health insurance at all. At least 100 million with health insurance have coverage that is desperately inadequate. Now, employer health, as you know if you read the newspapers, employer health benefits are sharply declining in coverage, or entirely. Drug costs are rising 10 to 15% every year. Job-related injuries and deaths are constantly on the rise. And just in this past week or so, in the New York Times is a headline, Health Leaders Seeking Consensus on Uninsured. This is what I referred to earlier this evening. I thought when I started reading this article, momentarily, and then I corrected myself because I was going, Doug, don't wake up. You know, it's a bad habit. Momentarily, I thought, hey, it's about time these companies, these corporations woke up to the need for a universal health care system. I thought they would. And then I read this article. This group is applying lessons learned in the battle over the Clinton health plan. Where the Clinton health plan came, started in 1993, that is to say when the Clintons, Hillary and whatever his name is, had a conference about like this, as a, in effect the predecessor of this, they ruled out any discussion of universal health care. They ruled it out. It could not be discussed. This was their great political strategy tactic, okay? Because if we have discussion of universal health care, well, we can't win in the first place, so because we can't win, we might as well win on what we want. What did they want? What they wanted was something that had nothing to do with health care. Political power, whatever it is. So what the debate was about was, in effect, how would the HMOs work? That was what it was about. So the group is applying lessons learned in the battle over the Clinton health plan. I thought members said they were learning, listening carefully to one another, trying to build the trust. They are not trying to remake the healthcare system or to guarantee insurance for every American through one big program, they said, the group said. The group is considering these options. I have five listed here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Each one of them with an exclamation point written in. The federal government could require parents to arrange health insurance for their children up to a certain age, say 21. They say they could apply, require parents to take out insurance, private insurance, of course. So that's going to take care of the children, huh? If the children were not eligible for public programs like Medicaid, the parents could obtain tax credits to meet the cost. Well, tax credits for people who can't afford something cannot be very high to meet the cost, okay?